Welcome to another episode of Beta Talk. I'm with my usual guest host, Ken Bones, Bonesy as we call him. I'm with Brandon.
Hello.
And I'm also with another one of our friends, another engineer who's not been on the podcast before, and that's Bill Johnson. And I'm hosted by Kenza. Now, Kenza are very well known in this industry for ground source heat pumps. So I came to visit them today along with my engineers and very, very impressed. We're all very impressed. We've all known about Kenza. Set up, I think, by a guy called Guy, who's their technical director. Kind of reminds me of my grandfather, actually, because my grandfather was a technical director who set up sort of some of the oil burner companies in this country. And you can tell instantly when you walk into Kenza, there's a nice atmosphere. They know what they're talking about. And one of the things they're talking about is heat pumps. So I'm going to introduce you to Darren Veal. Now, Darren, what is your role at Kenza?
So my role is technical support, commissioning and training here at Kenza.
How long you been with them?
6 years now.
Enjoying it?
Yeah, love it. Absolutely love it.
What's sort of changed in them 6 years?
Oh, massive changes we've seen. Yeah. I think the industry's changed a lot. In as much as I think it took a long time for us to get the message out there. I think we're still trying to get the message out there and trying to make heat pumps more mainstream. I think training's changed a lot. MCS, oil prices, you know, there's a lot of things that have had knock-on effects to us being able to sell a heat pump.
Now, I mentioned your technical director, Guy. Now, I've not actually met Guy personally, but I've seen him on some YouTube videos, which I really like watching. He comes across as very technical and very down to earth. So how did he start this company up?
Yeah, so Guy and his partner Richard Freeborn were business partners, and they first built their first heat pump in a garage, in their own garage. It was predominantly used for heating, not for hot water. I don't think they could get the temperatures back then. The cylinders weren't available. I think that was used, and then it went on from there, basically. It was one after that was built for another friend, and then slowly they were like, this really works. This is, you know, they knew the technology. They were both marine,
engineers.
Engineers. Thanks.
Same as my grandfather was,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And just with their knowledge, they've slowly evolved that heat pump into a better quality heat pump. And looking at different refrigerant types, as we're aware, we can achieve better temperatures. So then hot water was suddenly brought into it. And that was a big thing, really, stepping up from just being heating only to being able to provide heating and hot water. All of a sudden, you've got a solution for a house.
What I'm going to do, I'm sort of very aware of my audience, and some of the audience we've got are kind of people that will probably be thinking about buying a ground source heat pump. And so in a moment, we'll sort of talk about how a ground source heat pump works. One of the things I want to also talk to Kenza about, and some of my engineers are very keen on this, is something called district and community heating. Bill, I'm going to bring you in on this one. What is district and community heating?
It's basically where you spread the heat from a central source around the different buildings where it's needed. It could be a communal building where you've got blocks of flats, or it could be individual houses, but they're all linked up using a system of pipes bringing heat or energy into the building. Now, the interesting thing about Kenza's method is that instead of using heated water, preheated water from a boiler, they're just bringing the ambient temperature water into the individual property.
So we'll discuss exactly how a ground source heat pump works. Now I'm going to bring Brandon in.
It's just a fridge, isn't it?
So I think some of our listeners will want to understand there's a difference between the brine that's circulating around under your ground or in a borehole. And then where does that go?
Okay, so any form of heat pump, we need a source of heat that we start with. Now, we've discussed air sources previously, and in that instance, we take the heat out of the ambient temperature in the air. The difference with a ground source is we'd be taking that, as the name suggests, from the ground. Now, normally, that would be through a closed pipe system that's underground, either vertically in a borehole or laying horizontally underground. So we pass what we call brine. It's normally actually a glycol solution. Brine, to me, coming from a marine background, is salt water. But we pass what we call the brine through that system. It heats up, typically 4 to 5 degrees, and then we use that as our feed heat in order to put through the fridge cycle, which then gives us our secondary heat that we can put out into the heating system or the hot water or wherever we require heat.
So it's worth mentioning to the listener that that water or brine does not mix with our refrigerant in the exchanger.
No, classically
it?
We use a pair of plates.
And
you use, is it in yours?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Your plates.
Pair of plate heat exchangers.
So it's also worth mentioning, so that brine's quite important to get right, isn't it? So when you guys out there doing this sort of stuff, you measure and test this brine, don't you?
Yeah, for many things. So we test it to make sure it's not just all going furry and full of bacteria, which can happen, because unfortunately the glycol is a great food stock for bacteria. So we test that this stuff isn't going to freeze, because when it gets very cold, it doesn't work very well. When it turns into ice, it's slightly harder to pump. So we test the glycol level in it to make sure it's protected.
Capacity,
yeah, that also affects the amount of glycol we put in, affects the heat capacity of it, specific heat capacity. Unfortunately, the more glycol we put in, the less we have, the less heat capacity we have. And then we test it, where are we up to? So we've done biocide to make sure there's nothing growing in it, and we've made sure that it's not going to freeze in our pipes. We also, I think we'll probably get onto that later, I think I'll pass that over to your man here, to Darren, is we have to make sure we have enough capacity in the ground that actually we can draw enough heat out without freezing around the ground. Because obviously as we're drawing heat out, then it's going to cool that area. Now, soil doesn't flow like air or water, so we have to make sure that we certainly have enough capacity that we can extract enough kilowatts out of it without freezing it.
And how do you go about doing that, Darren? So you've obviously got some sort of calculation process.
Yeah, a lot of it is built into our quote builder, so we don't actually do that on an individual basis per project. The computer system does that, but it draws in from various websites, geological sites. So what we're looking at is the types of ground that we're going into, the thermal conductivity of that ground. And initially, we're always going to start with a property and say, look, how much energy does that property need? And then we'll look at the ground available and calculate how much we need to allow that heat pump to run to deliver that temperature into the property. Brandon's quite right in what he said. But what we would do is, you've got to think about the recovery time. A heat pump will run and it will get to the room temperature. But what you're actually doing while you're running your heat pump is actually lowering your ground temperature. Mm. We need to make sure that ground can recover that temperature when the heat pump switched off.
And how do you go about that then? Is that just making sure you've got the area?
Yeah, I think as a typical example, if you had, say, a 250 square meter house, and you're looking at a new build, something like 40 watts per meter squared is new build regs, we would typically say that needs 10 kilowatts of energy, just as a rough guide. And then we would look at, historically, we know a 50 meter slinky will generally give you about 5 kilowatts. Now, that 5 kilowatts needs to be taken from a 50 meter trench spaced at 5 meter centre. So it needs 5 meters of ground to recover that energy from. Okay, so we could look at that quite simply and say you need 2 50 meter slinkies. You might need more energy from the ground if you're then going to run a cylinder for 2 hours a day. Okay, so it could be that there's slightly more.
Now, I was driving in with Bill this morning, and Bill, we were talking about the geology of this country, because it's quite unique, aren't we, this country?
Extremely varied. The UK has probably got, well, the British Isles are probably the most complex geology in the world. Britain is formed from basically three continents that collided hundreds of millions of years ago. And so we've got different geologies in different parts of the country, depending on where those continents originated. Some of it originated in the South Pole. Some of it originated on the other side, in the west and the east. It's extremely old. So we've got a variety of very old rocks, like granite. Then you've got the sedimentary rock, like limestone and sandstone. And then you've got the clays, which are basically the residue of all of these different stones that have been ground away by the glaciers during the last few ice ages, and are just common erosion. Now we're down to the bedrock in a lot of places, covered over with hundreds of meters of clay in some cases. Add to the mix, you've had all the seismic activity of the collision of the continents, which happened over a long period of time, and we're talking geological terms, so you're talking hundreds of millions of years. every time there's a little slip in the landscape, it creates heat, so it changes the nature of the rocks underneath. And we're having to deal with all of that. So it is a little complicated, so it's probably why we have some of the best drillers in the world, and also best mining engineers, like in Cornwall, where they've had to mine through some of the most difficult rocks there are to extract the minerals. So we have a lot of knowledge in the UK of the nature of the ground, which is a great benefit to us.
So for me, is listening to that, I'm not a geology expert, but if we have got this really good base of knowledge, it kind of makes sense that we use that knowledge and we really push ground source heat pumps, doesn't it? I mean, we all know that we're kind of up against the boiler industry, and we've talked earlier about how we've got high-rise blocks of flats that have got gas boilers in and having gas boilers replaced. We can actually use heat pumps in these blocks of flats, can't we, Dan? We can.
Yeah,
you've got a system for it. We call it the shoebox, I think we called it.
Yeah, it's the shoebox.
That's what he told me it was
called. The Kenza shoebox. It was designed specifically to go in a kitchen cupboard or in an airing cupboard. We do two sizes of unit, 3 kilowatt and 6 kilowatt. The 6 kilowatt is actually a twin. They can both achieve 65 degree hot water and will sit comfortably underneath a cylinder in an airing cupboard. Now, what we find with district systems, a lot of the time there's not the vast amount of ground that comes with a block of flats. Usually there's a car park and a bit of a footpath around the block of flats. So typically what we do there is what we call boreholes, where we drill down to around about 100, 150 metres per borehole, link them all together, bring them back to a manifold, and then bring maybe two, maybe three or four pairs of header pipes back up through a riser cupboard in the flats. And then they literally feed each heat pump within each flat. So each customer essentially could just pay their own bill, their own electricity bill. We've got a cold array rather than having a central plant producing heat elsewhere and then losing heat on the way to the building or to the flat. We've got a cold array that picks heat up all the way into that heat pump, gaining energy rather than losing energy.
Yeah, this was really interesting to me because I saw this so-called shoebox on the side, and it really isn't very big at all. I mean, you say it fits in a kitchen cupboard. It would fit in half a kitchen cupboord, wouldn't it? It doesn't
absolutely
take up the whole
height.
It's not like an under-counter fridge.
Cupboard.
It's tiny. Yeah. And I presumed when he said, oh, we use them in flats, I presumed it was an HRU, so heat interface unit, that actually they'd have a big external plant and they were putting heat up and then taking it off and just putting it through a plate into the flat. But no, it is a tutti. I mean, it really is tutti. I don't know if that's the word.
Yeah, it's the size, just
small.
Over the size of an average microwave.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good good way of explaining it. Four tappings coming out the top. It's just a microwave with a screen on the front rather than a door.
And
it could be rather confusing if you've had a few too many beers.
And unlike gas boilers, as we know, I mean, there's lots of components you sort of fit ancillary to a gas boiler. I mean, it might, not that many people do, but it might need an external expansion vessel. It'll need a deaeration device. It'll need they do need a magnetic filter, but as we know, magnetic filters aren't the what the industry thinks they are. But whereas this just literally is a box, so it's a space-saving thing. Now, I speak at something called Low Carbon Homes, where I speak to local authorities who are obviously in charge of these big sort of buildings. I mean, this makes a sort of perfect solution, what they're looking for to meet their zero carbon targets, doesn't it? Or net zero carbon targets.
Yeah, absolutely. It hits all the sweet spots, if you like. From a funding point of view, I think there's still some eco-funding available. I think what we look at is fuel poverty, because a lot of the time you're looking at, you know, some of the tenants, they can't necessarily afford to run the existing systems, and it's really important that they can actually use a system that they can afford to turn on and feel comfortable with, and I think a ground source offers that.
Have you worked with many local authorities, Kenza?
Yeah, all across, right the way across the country.
So they're actually engaging and understanding the technology then?
Absolutely.
Well, that's good news, isn't it? So as an engineer, and the engineers I've got in this room have sort of worked around this sort of stuff, let's say you're a gas engineer and you're getting excited about this sort of technology, sort of what advice do you sort of give them to sort of how to get into it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I've seen, especially in the last 6 years, as we talked earlier about the changes, I think I've seen more and more gas installers coming to us, looking to get into the market, working out how what the best route is. And a lot of the time, they just don't know where to go. There isn't enough places for them. Now, if they're very basic and they're just almost sort of basic plumbers, then we'd advise those guys to look on the website, get their knowledge up to scratch a little bit, and then come and see us. Yeah, make an appointment, come and see us. We offer free bespoke training to those guys. You know, I could be sitting in front of architects, consultants, all sorts of various engineers, or it could just be, you know, a guy that knows how to fit a bathroom suite. But we're finding more and more people are learning slowly about heat pumps. And we need to, you know, Kensah see it, the future as being training as big a part of that company growth as anything else. It's the biggest part of development. You know, you teach one guy to fit a heat pump and he's away. You
know? I mean, Brandon and I and Ken, and we often talk about the training, and something we're going to be working on very soon is making some sort of nice YouTube videos which will help anyone that sort of wants to go into the training, which will just help them sort of start to get an overview. I want to bring Bill back in, because Bill, you've got a background in power stations, haven't I?
Most things, actually.
So, because obviously one of the things people question with heat pumps is the grid. Can the grid cope and stuff like that? We see this all the time on our social media sites. Now, you like I say, you've worked in power stations, haven't
you? Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your thoughts about that.
I think to begin with, the decarbonising of the national grid generally, and the changes that are coming in with the changing emphasis on the distribution network operators, the people who run the wires, they're changing to be a distribution service operator, which changes the way they can go about business. So instead of generating all the electricity in a central power station, a large central power station, and distributing around the country, there's more opportunity for generating it locally and then distributing it around the small networks. That then means that we can concentrate on where the electricity is needed. But by just the decarbonisation of the electricity grid, now the electricity is lower carbon than gas when you're burning gas. So the old policy of encouraging gas boilers to replace electric heaters, and now it doesn't make sense. A heat pump running on electricity gives you that boost. So even if it's just straight off the grid with a carbon content of say 250. It does vary, so I'm using 250 as an average. 250 grams of carbon per kilowatt hour, which is around about the same, similar to a gas boiler. Then you divide that by at least 3 with the heat pump, because that's the leverage that you get. Now, in all the years that I've been working on heat pumps, probably since 2006, we've been increasing the number of heat pumps that are on the grid. And yet, the national grid consumption has dropped in that time. We're now using less electricity overall. So without going into any detailed numbers, despite the number of heat pumps that there are actually working out there, we've reduced our electricity consumption. That says to me there's still capacity. There's plenty of capacity. The problem the industry has, I think, is they don't understand the volumes. They're assuming that every house that's got a 25 or 30 kilowatt boiler in is going to need 25 or 30 kilowatts of electrical energy going in. That's not the case. Boilers are usually four times bigger than they actually need to be for the heating. And then the heat pump only uses a third to a quarter of the energy that's coming out in heat. So I think the industry has not got its ideas right. They're thinking that they're going to have to replace gas in its entirety, and that's not the case at all. The amount of electricity that's going to be needed to drive all these heat pumps is a lot less than people are perceiving. But then, with a good heat pump and a good system, you can build in energy storage, because a 250-litre cylinder will actually hold more energy than a Tesla wall battery for a fraction of the cost. You're going to need one anyway. So if you can regulate the time that the heat pump runs, so stop it running at the peak times and allow it to run at the off-peak times or when there's a glut of renewable electricity on the grid, sun shining and the wind's blowing, for instance, then there's plenty of scope to incorporate heat pumps with a minimal disruption to the system that we've got.
I want to validate what Bill's just said there. I mean, we get asked all the time about can the grid cope with EV and heat pumps and stuff, and Bill's right in what he's saying, that we are actually using less energy or electrical energy than we were about 15, 20 years ago with the same infrastructure. Yes, okay, you might get a very thin leg of the network in localized areas. So you do have to be careful. And what people are now starting to think about is actually small villages or even small streets are starting to think collectively and maybe doing very localized energy production, whether it be a turbine, battery linked into a solar farm. And also the smart grid is also going to come along. So instead of overloading the grid at certain times of the day, what we're going to try and do, or what's happening with appliances, any household appliances, including heat pumps, they are actually going to be connected to the grid. And they will be told at certain times and points of the day, especially around the sort of 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, when everybody comes home and starts cooking and put their dinner on and having cups of tea, certain appliances will be told to back off their energy consumption. And what that does, you do that nationally, and what that does, it's trying to balance out the grid so they don't actually need to fire up another power station to cover you cooking your dinner. So we've got all these technologies that are coming together, but certainly local community efforts are now talking and engaging with policymakers, as we done on the podcast the other day. And they're now thinking to not always rely on the national grid, but perhaps do it a bit more locally.
I want to pick up this point about the shoebox that you manufacture down, and try and get across to consumers that listen to this program the difference between that and a heat interface unit. What is the difference?
I think with the shoebox, what we're doing, as I was speaking earlier, is with the cold array coming up through the riser and coming to the heat pump, I think where there's no central plant, we've not got any heat losses. So like I said earlier, it's just heat gain. And the shoebox, because a 306 kilowatt unit sized correctly for the flat, like I said, the customer is going to get their own bill. There's no need for metering. It's a simple standalone system connected to a ground array that doesn't need any servicing that you might need with heat interface units. There's no heat loss. The metering, there's a lot of benefits. It's far simpler. It's just a lot simpler. And I think blocks of flats have an issue with cooling as well. And suddenly running a lot of cold ground array pipes up risers gives an opportunity to use some of that cooling as well.
Because as we all know, the refrigeration cycle seems to confuse. It's confusing if you're not used to it, because it's this whole mindset of temperature means heat. And so I think it's worth mentioning to sort of some of these listeners how this cold water that's coming up the riser is actually it's got energy in it that goes to these shoeboxes, and then that energy gets transformed into very, very usable heat. Bill, how would you describe that different to heat interface units? How would you describe it?
Thermal interface unit takes the heat from a combustion source normally, generally circulated at high temperatures, and then usually aimed for about 80 degrees, because this is what the heating industry is used to. Then they have probably a 15 to 20 degrees temperature difference between their flow and return. So we've got 80 degrees coming out of the boiler and maybe 50 going back in, or 55, because you've got to take into account the losses from the pipe work. By the time it gets to the property, you're probably looking at about 70 degrees, because you've lost temperature through the ground Now, that represents energy that's just lost. So you've got to oversize the boiler to begin with because you won't be able to deliver what you're actually generating. So you're going to lose a lot. Then the pipe work is going to deteriorate because it's working at a higher temperature. The heat interface unit itself is is a heat exchanger between the water that's being circulated and the water that's going around your central heating and what's heating your hot water. But often it's got to be much bigger than it needs to be because they'll heat the water, your domestic hot water, the what's coming out of the tap is heated as it's being used. So you've got to deliver quite a high amount of heat for that. With the shoebox concept is taking a smaller amount of heat, but over a longer period of time to heat the hot water, store it in a cylinder. That way you don't have to have such big pipes. You don't have the same losses because, as Darren said, you've got gains. The pipe worker is gaining heat, not losing it. So it's an advantage. By storing the energy in your cylinder, you can heat it up over an hour, say, even if you're going to use it over a matter of minutes. So you have a small device which is running on your own domestic power supply, which is not very much. You can probably plug one of these into just ordinary 3-pin socket. That's the sort of scale we're talking about. It's very small in terms of energy use. In reality, when you look at a lot of people with flats, they're using storage heaters. Often during the day, they've run out of heat, so they have to run a fan heater to supplement it. A fan heater may be 1 or 2 kilowatts of draw on the grid because there's nothing left in there. So actually, they end up using more peak load than you do with a heat pump. But going back to what we were talking about, which was the using a heat interface unit with a combustion source, you've got two pieces of plant. You've got your interface unit in the flat, and you've got a complicated and unreliable device that's burning
expensive
fuel.
And they have service costs involved.
Maintenance costs are very high on the central plant, whereas with a ground loop in the ground, maintenance costs are very low. It's very simple. You've got to keep a check on the quality of the fluid that's being pumped through there to make sure it doesn't get any contamination. But that's a fairly straightforward check that can be done on a regular basis. And basically looks after itself. Each individual unit in the in each apartment is probably as reliable as a domestic fridge, because that's basically what's in it.
Which lasts quite a long time, doesn't it?
And another thing, of course, with a traditional district heating system, as you say, you're typically running at 80 degrees out of the plant room, and that's in order to give us that fantastic hot water response, is the fact that that is kept like that 365 days a year, right through the summer, because it needs to be maintained because people still want a hot shower. Whereas the beauty of these, I mean, they've really blown my mind, these little shoe boxes. I'm already thinking of a job in town. I was approached by a guy yesterday who just bought the NatWest Bank. And he's just built 17 flats beside me. And anyway, I'm going to speak with Steve later. So if you're listening, Steve, I would have had this conversation with you. And the fact that actually, if that flat's not occupied, there's no need to produce any heat in it. Or if actually somebody wants it at a lower temperature. You know, we all know the horror stories of the old Soviet systems where you had 2-foot diameter pipes that were coming along. When they got to the end of the road, they just flowed out into the stream. And that was that vast amount of energy being sent down. The efficiency gains just strike me as absolutely wonderful. The other thing is, you mentioned you don't get heat loss. You also mentioned the cooling in flats, Darren. And of course, if we haven't got dirty, great big hot risers coming through the building, we're not overheating our communal spaces or our lift shafts or, you know, those. It's just
absolutely
a win-win.
Yeah,
it's just an
absolute It's a natural scalable solution.
How long's this technology been around?
Have you got any I can put in my van on the way in?
How long's this technology been around and why haven't we been using it?
Since the 50s?
I think it's been around for 35, 40 years. I think Kensa have developed that shoebox primarily for that reason, for the flats and for that district system. And we've been plugging away at that very slowly. and have grown organically purely by getting our first. I don't know whether you remember, you spoke to David Brim earlier, and one of the first projects was just a few small flats in a tiny village in mid-Devon.
Why are we still putting gas boilers in these high-rise flats?
Nathan, come on.
The boiler industry is a very powerful lobby.
So he was right to me to say it.
Going back to Kenza then, so as a company, how are you getting that message out there? So Ken and I were talking to a lovely gentleman the other day called Richard, who's involved in policy. And we learned a little bit from him how policy works. It involves lobbying groups. How are you... I mean, I know Bean, and you know Bean from the Ground Source Heat Pump Association. How are organisations like that getting this message out there?
I think really through our website. I think marketing do a great job of trying to highlight these schemes. Initially, it was getting that first scheme. And once, you know, it's like the snowball effect. Once you've got one, other people start to look at that, see the data from it, see the results, see the benefits. And a lot of it is just word of mouth. And we just have been continually almost arguing on about this for the last sort of 10 years, really. And finally seeing fruition, it's come to fruition. And it's incredible the amount of people that now want to be a part of Kenza and love the concept. And slowly, they very slowly understood. And sometimes you have meetings with people and you sit down and you go through all this and you think all of a sudden you see the penny drop. And then it's just an absolute game changer. I mean, just going back to heat interface units and central plant, if you think that, you know, the maintenance costs and all the rest of it, but also imagine this, if that breaks down, that central plant, you could have a tower block out of, everyone's got no heating, you'd have a riot on your hands. You know, if Kenza shoebox breaks down, if it breaks down, there's four valves on there, you turn them off, you unplug it, and you swap it over. It's that simple. You know, there's one customer that's going to be unhappy for a very short amount of time. I think that's a major benefit for Kenza Heat Pumps, having that small domestic unit that they can fully control and be in charge of their own bill and their own usage is a massive, massive bonus and advantage for anyone wanting to run their own system.
Building developers, I mean, obviously people talk about new builds. Have you got them getting interested in this technology? Are you finding?
Absolutely. I think the way the certain counties have gone that you cannot fit a gas boiler into a new build is a game changer for us. On the heat pump side of it, selling just domestic heat pumps, we've seen the influx in new builds. It's a no-brainer. They've got a digger on site. They've got a bit of ground. They've got a plot. They're going to put something in anyway. You can budget that into the price of your new build, and it's a fantastic system.
Brandon, we've just talked about new builds, and obviously the date 2025 has sort of been branded on everyone's...
It used to be the future, didn't it? That, now it's only just around the corner.
Do you think the gas boiler industry will be allowed to put hydrogen-ready boilers in to do
what
build?
What are you asking me for? I don't do gas.
In 2025.
I kind of watched the whole hydrogen debate, and... part of me despairs and part of me just really enjoys the comedy of it, if I'm honest. I think it's a bit of a red herring, personally. I'm not entirely convinced that the infrastructure is there for it. I know some people disagree.
It's a distraction.
That's how I see it, a bit of a distraction. I understand, you know, they've got Audis to drive and stuff like that. They need to keep selling gas boilers. You know, why wouldn't they? Everyone has their own opinion on what they want to put in. I can see that it might have some use in certain circumstances, should you put it that way. But I'm not entirely convinced. First of all, I'm not entirely convinced they're going to do anything in 2025 because that's like governmental and they can make stuff and, you know, I'm not entirely sure. Was it just this morning or yesterday Boris Johnson said we're not driving, no new diesel cars and petrol cars or hybrids after 35? It might happen, but...
I can remember when we were going to be, all houses were going to be zero carbon by 2016.
Yeah, there you go. We're all going to be riding hoverboards by the year 2000.
Yep.
I'm really disappointed about that. But I mean, I'm old enough to have a license and everything now.
I can remember when I was 13 and we were only 30 years away from having nuclear fusion.
Oh, yeah.
We're still only 30 years away from nuclear fusion, 50 years later.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring in nuke because Bill and I were chatting about nuke. Obviously, electricity is generated somehow and we've got nuclear power stations, and we've got gas turbines, and I think we've got still six coal power stations. Just explain, I'm not for nuclear, you're not for nuclear, Bill, have I got that
right? No. And I understand the concept, I've worked in the nuclear industry, but from my point of view, it is such a dirty concept. We're creating something that had deteriorated and vanished from the planet billions of years ago. And here we go, digging up the remnants of it, giving it a shake, and getting it going again. This is a product that existed before any life on Earth. And it's the total antithesis of everything.
Is it a little bit like we should leave a sleeping dog?
Absolutely. It's in the ground, leave it, forget it. It is. We should not be playing with it. It's the waste of a dead planet. And if we're not careful, that's what we're going to create, is another dead planet.
I mean, those who are for it, and I'm not particularly, it has to be said, of course, their argument is it's low carbon. My argument is the amount of housing we have to give it for the next grillion years, and the amount we have to look after it, and this, that, and the other. I mean, really, no.
That's,
I mean, the reason I brought the topic up is because obviously you've got people that like the idea of electric heat. They like this idea of us engineers discussing about
it's a marketable heat pumps. Product, that's
and then,
why.
And then obviously we...
Too cheap to meter.
We create that electricity, so there's some people out there that like nuclear power stations. I just don't like them. And as we know, it's, I think we use carbon as the catalyst, I suppose. What do the French use? They use something else, don't they? Seawater, or not seawater?
They use a water moderator. So they process the water, which then they process it to, so it's high in deuterium, I think. Excuse me if I don't get
one
the word
with
right.
D, I think,
something
it?
Beginning with D. It's a kind of hydrogen isotope. We use carbon in our old gas-cooled reactors, which works very well. It's very stable, and we're able to refuel the reactors under load. So our reactors are very reliable. They produce a lot of electricity constantly. The French concept is simpler and cheaper to build, but you have to fill it up with the fuel and let it run until it runs out, and then break into it. And then refuel it. So it runs out of fuel gradually, so the power that is given off reduces. And that's what we'll go into, because it's cheaper. But you've got to start with the fuel. Where does the fuel come from? They are removing mountains in certain parts of the world, usually the third world, Africa and India, where they'll take a mountain, complete whole mountain, and reprocess it into a few kilograms of uranium that is fissile, that can actually be used. The amount of damage that's done to the environment just getting the fuel to begin with.
And they're trying to produce, I suppose, the end product is plutonium, isn't it? Is that right?
Well, what started the industry going was weapons-grade plutonium, because it comes out of nuclear reactors. We've got so much weapons-grade plutonium now, we don't need to produce it. But they quite like the energy that it gives off, and it's basically a big steam engine which generates the electricity with the turbines. But it is a multi-trillion pound industry, and they don't let go of things very easily. To a lot of people and politicians, they see it as convenient because it's something that they could turn off if need be, so it gives people power. A central source of energy which everybody relies on, we're all dependent on it then. I think the concept of distributed energy is a bit worrying for a government, because...
I'm waiting for someone to pull the plug. Literally and metaphorically, aren't they?
But with distributed energy, it's more democratic. Mm-hmm. You can't just pull the plug and stop everybody, because everybody's got a say in it.
Is it Sellafield C they're currently building, is it?
Hinkley Point C.
Hinkley Point C, that's
it's,
it, sorry.
It's about 50 miles from here.
Is it the most expensive structure on Earth?
Probably
to be now, and
likely to be. There are two things that you don't know about a nuclear power station. One is how long it's going to take to build. The other is how much it's going to cost to build.
Yeah.
There's a third one. You don't know how much it's going to cost to decommission.
Well, I have a friend who started his career as a plumber, and he started his career decommissioning one of our plants in Wales, and he retired before they'd finished. So, which is pretty good going. Mm-hmm. Started as an apprentice, taking pipes out.
One of the questions people ask is they get the idea of heat pumps, or they really like the idea of heat pumps, and they often then say, well, where's all this electricity? If we all went to heat pumps, where's all this electricity come from? So is that something we need to worry
about? Comes
out
the plug, doesn't it?
Britain is one of the highest wind resources. That's it. Yes, thanks, Brandon.
You're welcome.
The highest wind resources in Europe, and we're only just tapping into it. They've stopped building wind on land because it reduces the price of houses, and it spoils the view from your estate.
Lots of people have complained about it.
Yeah, and it spoils the view from the golf course, so that's a bad thing. So we'll build them out at sea where it's much more expensive. And the cables have got to come in through across the shore, which then the Crown Estate can then... I'm saying all sorts of things here, aren't I?
No, you carry on. You're welcome, but you carry on, my old lad.
So there are lots of people tapping into it. We can produce this electricity,
yeah,
can't we?
There are more and more arrays coming in online. Often we're up to 35% of our electricity coming from wind alone.
Because I'll hold my hands up. I mean, whenever I'm involved in the discourse around this, I would sometimes think, well, have we got enough electricity if we all went heat pumps? You know, that's something that even people that really like heat pumps were sort of thinking about. But it turns out that with different ways of distributing electricity, and not from one central point, it's a viable option, isn't it?
Renewables in the UK is snowballing, absolutely snowballing, and we are world leaders in what we're doing and what we're producing. So I think, you know, we've already talked about we're already using less energy than we were 15 years ago on the grid currently, and we are leading in producing renewable energy. I can't really see, unless we all have a heat pump and an electric car delivered on our doorstep tomorrow, then that might be a challenge. But I think it's like a two-horse race, and they're running in parallel and they're snowballing in parallel. So when the little kinks really do come to the crux, maybe in another 10, 15 years' time, where they might start seeing some bottlenecks in the grid and the electricity and everything else, they would have already been seeing that coming and planning for the future. But I think, and from what data I've read, there is no issues currently at the moment or foreseeable issues currently at the moment for the grid infrastructure.
Well, I'm going to stop it right there. We're going to have a part two with Kenza, and I'll have the same guests. I'd like to say thank you to my sponsor, which is MCS. You can look them up on the website at MCS Certified. If you like this podcast, you can follow it. And apparently, I've been told you can also leave feedback or give it a 5-star rating. So please do that, because I think it helps with search engines find it. So people that are wanting to sort of learn about renewable technology or engage with the conversations, if you leave feedback on your podcast platforms, that helps search engines pick it up. And if you ever want to sort of get involved in the topics, or you think there's some topics we haven't discussed, please contact me at learn@betateach.co.uk. Thank you very much.